Okay, let's get started here. Glad everybody can make it, and it's so good that we don't dissolve in the rain, you know, that, unlike the Wicked Witch of the West. Just a couple items. On last Thursday, we had the midterm team project presentations, which went pretty well. I want to encourage all the project teams on a couple things. Number one, I think it's always a good idea, whether you're presenting or writing something, to have an abstract right in front to tell the people what you're doing. You know, so the, like the first couple sentences should be, you know, this project addresses such and such need. And that way you get everybody that's reading or listening in the right frame of mind to know what's coming. Because if you don't, you leave them guessing for a long time, and people can get lost. So if you state the summary right in the beginning, I think that helps people, you know, keep track of stuff. Again, for people working on projects, there's only like 4 weeks left in the quarter, so you really have to make best use of the remaining time. So that means working continuously, you know, nonstop, and making sure you make progress every week. And about that progress, I like to hear about your successes. So just email me every once in a while, so I know that you're working on stuff and you're not being stuck. And if you need a little bit of help, I could direct you to people. Doug Schwant here has helped out student teams in the past, and he's going to be available to help others, including the door opening team. I think you can make good use of Doug, so please get together. For today, we have a double header. We have two presenters, but each taking half the time, so don't worry about that. So we have two handouts. So make sure everybody gets two single sheets of paper. Okay. We have this one item for contemplation. This is a story about the Stanford physician who was in a bike accident, and he lost the ability to walk, but he can stand, and so now he uses a Segway to get around. But because he looks like he's not disabled and is using a Segway and with a doctor's coat, maybe a lot of people think that he's being sort of elite, you know, and using technology where he shouldn't be using it. So a lot of people have made fun of him and jeered him and tried to push him off his Segway, not knowing that he really needs it. So this was in the Stanford Daily, and they even did a little cartoon of him. So it's sort of an interesting concept where people who don't look disabled, who are making use of assistive technology, sometimes aren't viewed as needing the assistive technology. I'm not sure there's anything to discuss here, but if anybody has any thoughts. Okay. Uh-huh. Did he look like that?
No, his name is...
Yeah. Okay.
I thought it was interesting because I remember at the beginning when the Segway was brought out there, I think it was made for everyone, you know, like
right.
Still being useful, but
so here's an example of a device that can be an assistive technology for the right people, but in other cases it just could be a piece of recreational technology. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of unique. You don't come across that very often. Owen, did you have something?
I worked with a guy who was visually impaired.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And so even though it actually helps him, he'd rather not use it because of the reaction that he gets. But then there are times when he uses it specifically because then it's a way of showing that he's visually impaired.
Okay. All right.
Were you doing the mocking?
Just other people. It was unclear from the article. It wasn't
necessarily... Other physicians, nurses, patients?
It wasn't clear who did it, but...
Yeah,
it was obviously it was people who didn't know him and his condition. So.
But I mean, I can visualize other physicians mocking him.
Yeah.
That's probably routine practice.
Right. Yeah.
But not like patients, I can't imagine.
Yeah, it wasn't specific in the article.
Yeah, it's too bad.
You know, you can look up his name in the Stanford Daily, and you can find the entire article. Okay. So Thursday we're going to be talking about human subjects and research, and why is this important for you? Well, anytime you involve people other than project team people, you need to go through a human subjects and research, human consent form, which we have for this course. And that's to, you know, cover, make sure that the people that you're working with know their rights and know what to expect from whatever research you're doing. And obviously this is not needed if you're just talking to them, but if you're doing anything more, touching them, manipulating them, having them test something, that's where we need to have them sign the human consent form that we have. So Dr. Caratley from the VA, who is actually on the Institutional Review Board, who manages these kinds of things, will be talking to us on Thursday. And she's been doing it for quite a while, and she's an expert in this. So that'll be this coming Thursday. Okay. But today, we have two speakers, like I said, and the first speaker is my longtime colleague, Doug Schwant. And I remember when I first met Doug, he was doing a ME 210 presentation on his hand bike. That was so long ago, wasn't it, Doug?
Wow.
Yeah. So he was a master's student in mechanical engineering, creating the hand bike, which he'll discuss. After graduation, he continued the hand bike development at the VA and also worked on other projects at the Rehab R&D Center with me, including some projects that we shared together that he'll be talking about, and some new projects as well. And so Doug is the consummate mechanical engineer. And so he's going to show you how he's taken his expertise and using it to develop assistive technology devices, including robotics for physical therapy and other devices. So in the spare time, Doug's a springboard diving coach here at Stanford. So we'll transfer the mic and we'll hand it out.
He hasn't changed in all these years. So I typically work and talk with people more interactively. I'm not commonly giving talks about my work or thoughts on technology or rehab technology. But so please interrupt me or ask me questions while we go through this. I really just would like to show you a few of the projects that I've worked on, and hopefully this could be a little bit inspiring, because I've found that the work has been a lot of fun over the years, been able to go from one project to the next. And some of you are just starting out, and others have been doing many projects already over the years. So you'll know what I mean when you get into these projects, that they can be a lot of fun. So let's see. Just the right button here. So I thought I would just briefly go through a design process that I was presented to me when I was a student in what's 310 now, used to be called 210. It was the hand bike project here at Stanford. And then I'll give a few examples, and then a short perspectives that I've gathered over the years that help me in my design work. So first, this is sort of a step-by-step process that I try to follow. And it's iterative. I jump around in it, but I always try to make sure I don't miss some of the things. So just kind of scan through it here. You've already been going through some of these steps yourself. You're working on need assessment in the class and looking at what's been done. So that's the first. The first item is find out what's been done and find something that you're really interested in, because there's no sense working on something you don't really care about. It may be valuable to other people, but you want to make sure that it's of interest to you too while you work on it, so you don't waste everybody's time. Something that's I find a little bit boring sometimes is to find out what's been done before. It's interesting, but you really want to try to come up with something novel. It's more fun if you can do something exciting and new. But it's kind of embarrassing if when you finish, someone else points out that it was done 30, 40 years ago. Go through the steps. It helps makes your design that much better. Then you start stepping through, developing the ideas. You can use foam core and sketching, whatever you're comfortable with. And try to get a number of ideas, have brainstorming sessions. Remember during the brainstorming sessions that everybody's don't put ideas down too quickly. If someone has an idea you don't agree with, at least consider it. It's a time to get everything out on the table and look at what the options are. What I usually do then is select one concept, because it's really difficult to carry everything along in parallel. And you'll find that you've selected a preferred concept, and maybe a little while later you reconsider because something has reminded you of a specification, or it's just not going to work. So you go back and look at your other ideas and come back to them. So anyway, you can read through this later if you're interested. If you have any questions, just contact me about it. I thought I would go through some of the projects. I'm starting with a project that was my student project with Candy Mintz, who was another master's student with me. And it's funny because I went for months before I realized why my housemates were, every time I mentioned her name, would kind of smile. Because I'm like, Candy Mintz. And then, okay. So We had a small team, but it was very productive. We worked with Larry Leifer and Peter Axelson. Yeah, there's a Peter Johnson also. Peter Axelson, who you'll hear from in a couple of weeks, and he'll also mention the hand bike probably. He's an individual with lower limb paraplegia, was a master's student at the time, and he was also working as a consultant at the VA and the liaison with this project on the hand bike. So, okay, the hand bike, what is it? It's an, has anybody, who's heard of the hand bike? Besides Dave, and those who have heard me talk about it before, Owen's heard about it. The hand bike is an arm-powered two-wheeler. And I suppose the two-wheeler part is the main thing about it. Most arm-powered cycles are tricycles. And I know there's little side wheels, but you can ride on two wheels like a regular bicycle. And that's the fun part. Can anybody guess how you would maintain balance on a two-wheeler if you don't have the use of your legs? Does anybody have any ideas besides Dave? Well, there are side wheels. They're like little outriggers that can be lifted up. You see another wheel? Yeah, there's a side wheel. This is actually at the side, and it can be fastened down so you have a stable platform. They raise up like landing gear, I guess you'd say. Yeah.
So I can't really tell from the picture. It's clearly what President did, but you couldn't weigh it a lot at the bottom.
Oh. Yeah. That would help to have a low center mass. Definitely. And I remember helping Professor Kane years ago make a prototype of a unicycle that had weight low, and it helped make it more stable. So the hand bike is intended for anybody that doesn't have full use of their legs. It could be someone that's had paraplegia or amputations. We've had people with cerebral palsy use the bike. And able-bodied riders enjoy riding it too, which it's kind of an unusual experience. But no one has ideas about how the bike leans. I mean, how do you balance the bike, I should say? Has anybody heard of counter-steering on a motorcycle? It's this steer to balance. Yeah. So if you're on your bicycle, if you ride a bike and you can ride without hands, I don't recommend it. I do it all the time. But if you let go of the handlebar, keep your hands close in case you need them, and you pull back on the right side, you would think you'd make a right turn, but you make a very nice left turn. Turn the front wheel to the right, the bike leans to the left, the bike goes where the bike leans. And this was actually a key to making this successful, is that you can control the balance of the bike totally by steering it. I'll move on to a few other projects just to show some of the other projects. But if anybody has questions, or if you want me to bring the hand bike by sometime, I could be happy to do that. You can play on it outside when it's not raining. Here's some of the history of it. What's that?
There's candy up there.
Yes, there's candy mints right here. This is Candy. This is Peter Axelson, who will come and speak in a couple of weeks. This is me, and this is Peter Johnson, who's a frame builder and a machinist in Redwood City, bike builder. This was when I was a student, and things really haven't changed. It's right outside of the shops, and we had a design area in there. Tressiter hasn't changed, Terman hasn't changed at all. This is an older brother who helped one weekend to build a model. We just cut up old bikes and built one. We raced the hand bike, set a record speed. This gentleman had incomplete quadriplegia, and he set a world record speed of 25 miles an hour. And then Rick Hansen, who did pushed his wheelchair around the world and for the International Year of the Disabled Person in 81. This goes back a ways. I got started when I was about 4, so anybody's doing the math. Then we thought, well, it would be fun to do a tandem. So we first did what we called the hand bike tandem. We just stuck a back end onto it. And we had a remote steering, so both the front rider and the back rider could steer, which you can imagine leads to some conflicts at times. It wasn't a really good idea. Then we thought, if we're sitting on the front and we have use of our legs, why not put foot power on? So that's how we got what we call the sunburst. And this slide reminds me of what Dave was bringing up before about Dr. Paulus. Is that how you say? This photo was taken at a conference in Ottawa just after we finished this bike, and the woman in the front, is she disabled or is she able-bodied? Was she? So the point here was that we were trying to, the bike is unusual, it gets attention, it gets good attention and bad attention, but we wanted it to, the rider in the front to be in a position where an able-bodied rider or a disabled person might want to ride. She turns out she hadn't been on a bike for 12 years. She has MS, and she needed the arm stroke to help her legs through the weak part of her cranking. Okay, so there's a tandem version, and so these bikes are available. Turns out someone else was doing almost the same thing, the Counterpoint. I think it's now called the Viewpoint, and the name's changed.
Is that young guy with the mustache?
Yeah. It's a while ago. Okay, I'm just going to switch gears, show some other projects. It always feels like the fun projects are going to end. This is the last one. There's not going to be any new ones. And then you either think of one yourself or someone comes to you and says, I'd like some help. And it just seems like it keeps happening, which is fun. This is during a period of time where I was helping to work on exercise equipment for long-term space travel, which is another situation where an able-bodied person is essentially in a disabling environment. It's enabling in that you don't have to worry about gravity. You can get anywhere, but you can't swim to where you're going because the air doesn't move that well. And once you're in space, your muscles and your bones atrophy if you don't use them. You don't put enough loading on them. So This is a one concept that's based on the early, what's it called? Remember what this is called? Dynamic tensioning. Charles Atlas from the 20s, I think. Has anybody heard of this before? You know about that? And you've heard of the Nautilus machines, too? Well, Nautilus, Charles Atlas came up with this concept of push one part of your body against the other part. You can add more and more force while you move it. So you're moving like right arm against your left arm or arms against your legs, your head against your legs. You can do any combination. And I mentioned Nautilus because Nautilus had a patent for a machine that had its cams and so on, and there was one other one. But we worked with just ropes and pulleys so that we could make it very lightweight. The whole package weighs maybe 4 or 5 pounds, and this guy here on the left, Scott Perzinski, had it in space. Leg pressed 1,200 pounds of force with his legs. There's an instrumented pulley that's right on the harness. It's hard to see. It's actually down between his legs. It measures force, and it measures the play of the rope, and then you get all the information that way. Jim Anderson, who you'll hear a little bit about more later, is a machinist that Dave and I worked with for years at the VA. He's an amazing machinist. He's very kind. He's done so many things, special equipment for people with disability. He had trained at NASA, trained, loved life sciences. He had a boss that didn't like him. When he finished his apprenticeship, they put him over in the heavy scrap yards, and he quit. So something like 15 or 20 years later, maybe even a little bit more, he helped on this project, and this was his first flight hardware. So this is he did a beautiful job. These are almost like CNC machine parts with radiuses that sweep around the corners. Very beautiful work. And it was flight hardware. He's very happy about that. How am I doing for time, Dave?
It's 4:40.
4:40, okay. So this is a project I've worked on recently with a company in Chicago called Kinea Design. And it was started by two design professors at Northwestern and one physical therapy professor, Dave Brown, who Dave and I worked with at the VA before he went off to Chicago to be a professor there. The idea is essentially considered a robotic assist. It can help people who've had a stroke or Parkinson's, follows them around, catches them if they're about to fall. It can guide them. It has a torso controller. So I'll let Dave start. There's a video that shows it, and I'll just let it run. I think this is going to air on the Discovery Channel. I'm not sure if it's aired or not.
Yes.
Wayne Nims is getting set for the worst part of his day.
First time I did it, I went home. I felt like every muscle in my leg was somewhat aching. I wouldn't call it painful, but it just felt like you've been weightlifting or doing bike stuff. Every muscle from the top of my leg to down to my foot. Just move your hips around.
A little bit like one of those toy mechanical snakes, the boxes and sensors strapped to Dwayne's hips respond smoothly and effortlessly to his every movement.
You okay?
Dwayne begins to walk down the pathway. It's pretty obvious right away he's having difficulty. His entire left side is paralyzed, and he's being asked to walk over foam blocks of different heights. And within seconds...
Okay, you're fine.
And he is. The machine has caught him and suspended him in midair, so he hasn't been hurt by the fall.
What you do is you gain more confidence as you go. The machine catches you and it supports you.
This is the Kinney Assist robot, breakthrough technology developed in partnership with the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago. Designed to take over the hard grunt work of physiotherapy, it's the result of hundreds of hours of observation and study.
We had a group that actually almost folded their hands and watched and took very meticulous notes on what they saw the physical therapists doing and how those physical therapists interacted with patients on a day-to-day basis. The hands-on work that they did, the discussions that they had, what kinds of things that the specific therapists did with patients.
They challenged us to create a robotic system
that allowed them to do what they wanted to do, what they were trained to do, putting their hands on the patient and guiding the patient without having to do the grunt work of the walking and balance that is holding a person up and assuring their safety and that they wouldn't fall down.
I just want to let you know that we need to make these belts really tight, so Nicole and Jane are going to pull them pretty snug.
Okay, good.
It's Joy Ray's turn for torture. Like Dwayne, her stroke paralyzed the left side, and like Dwayne, she's deathly afraid of falling.
I fell a couple times whenever I was in rehab, and since then I've fallen a couple other times, one time breaking my collarbone.
Okay, Joey, so just start walking and try to walk as best as you can over the phone.
People are so afraid of falling that they actually get very resistant or reluctant to try things out. So a fear of falling actually becomes a fear of walking. And oftentimes a fear of walking becomes not going to walk at all. When we think about robots or robotics, we're sort of, you're thinking about the machines. You're thinking about the hardware, and the mechanics of the machine. Really, the key part of the robotic device here is not the device itself. It's the software. It's the control.
One of the features of this device is to assist patients that have difficulty standing up, which happens commonly with stroke patients. And those are these ring sensors that assist me in lifting the patient up. You can see from the point how easy it is for a physical therapist to lift the patient up. In fact, they're so sensitive that Alex can lift himself up.
There are 20 such sensors scattered over the device, detecting the forces and motions of the patient.
It reads where a patient is going.
I should probably curtail this, and it's online, so yes.
And sometimes it initiates that.
You can see the rest of it, yes.
For example, if you're in a bus, hold on.
Of the uneven...
To walk on.
Oh, I think it's just to challenge them, challenge an environment, and in a, holding on to them while they step over uneven surfaces. Is that
I mean, it seems like they have enough challenge to resist. Oh,
I see. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, we'll have to, that's a good question, why you would overdo it, but, okay. Let me push the right button first. There's other projects here. I'm running over. It's just like my design projects. Take a little too long on them sometimes. These projects are on the KineaDesign.com website. You can see some of these things. This is part of a bionic arm, that's DARPA's bionic arm for a replacement for, or it's a prosthetic limb for someone who's lost the use of their arm or lost their arm, amputated. That's currently what I'm working on as the new phase of this. So I just thought I would, these are a few of the little quips that the machinist, Jim Anderson, is, when I go into the shop, just distressed, it could be like months, almost a year on some big projects, and everybody else would be like, I can't stand this project. I'm tired of it. I want to get out of here. Take it away from me. And he would say things to me like, is that on here? Oh, Mount Everest is, you climb it one step at a time. Don't look at the top of the mountain. Just take the next step. And I managed to make it through the big projects, which is kind of nice because the longer, more complicated ones can be more gratifying sometimes. So again, I won't go through these. Do you have any questions? Any other questions? Yes.
I have a question regarding the bicycle.
Yes.
How much less power is there to go up this, like, uphills if you're pulling with your hands?
How much less power to go uphill?
Yeah. Is it difficult to climb over hills?
Oh, yes. It is definitely difficult to go up hills. We did put a very low gear on some of the prototypes of the hand bike, and I don't know if any of you have biked up the hill behind HP Hillview. It's called Hillview. It's, you go all the way up this hill.
I'm just saying that because I've seen
online just like $100 if you sort of put it on an electrical device on it with a battery. Oh, so that's yes. Yes, definitely. And devices which augment your power. So if you put in like 50 watts or 100 watts, it'll double it. It's a good idea, and the technology has improved, so that could be added. Yeah, good idea. Any other questions? There are other projects, and they're on these slides that you could look at later if you want online or wherever Dave has them, and ask if you have any questions about it or would like any help on your projects, just as someone else to look at it. Please feel free to contact me. That's it.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Is Jim still with
you? No, retired now.
Does he dabble at all?
A little bit. He has some back problems himself.
Yeah, it'd be nice if Jim comes in someday and you'll get a chance to meet him. If you have he's a very good person to have you look at his project. That's your project.
Mm-hmm. We'll see if we can get him here for Peter Axelson's talk.
Yeah, that'd be
in
great.
2 weeks.
And if you take him to, what's the name of that restaurant that he likes to go to?
Mandarin Gourmet.
He likes that, too. Okay. Yeah, he likes the... Anyway, if you take him to out for dinner, he'll sit there and work with you for an hour or two and look at your drawings and give you suggestions.
Okay.
I'm so sorry to be impolite, but I feel that...
Okay. Thank you, Doug. You're excused.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is Owen Edwards, and he's going to be talking about accessible recreation. And Owen, as you know, is a community member here and has sat in on all the lectures. So thank you for showing up and being a part of the course. And Owen has 7 years' experience teaching snowboarding and whitewater rafting, specializing in working with people with disabilities. He's worked at Challenge Aspen, where he's developed a curriculum for adaptive snowboard instruction and has worked on the industry-wide examinations for instructors at the beginner, intermediate, and intermediate stages for the American Association of Snowboard Instructors. He's been operations manager and a guide trainer for Environmental Traveling Companions Rafting Program, running one day and expedition trips on rivers across California for people with disabilities, including people who are blind and visually impaired, and people with traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injury and cerebral palsy. Owen has a master's degree in electronic engineering and worked for 10 years as a design engineer and project manager on embedded software, DSP firmware, semiconductor devices, and other consumer electronics before moving into the field of accessible recreation. So without further ado, let's bring Owen up here. Thanks. Okay, and props, oh boy. Okay, so just clip that on. Put that in your pocket.
Great.
And here's your...
forward and backward.
Great. And
your
lightsaber.
Okay, got it. Thanks. Well, the cool thing for me about talking about snowboarding and whitewater rafting is they're cool, which makes it really exciting. I've been involved, as Dave mentioned, for 7 years, and I'm happy to follow on from Doug because I think this builds on some of the stuff he talked about. I have been involved a lot with the teaching, and there are a lot of different aspects of teaching some form of recreation to people with disabilities. Snowboarding is a gravity sport, and the advantage of a gravity sport is gravity is helping you out. So the less effort that you put into it compared to something where it's more physical, cycling, which is less of a gravity sport. So you have an advantage for people with disabilities to work in gravity sports. The professional bodies that standardize skiing and snowboarding throughout the U.S. or instruction of it divide teaching into three parts: teaching concepts, learning concepts, and movement and performance concepts. And I'm going to focus on those because we're talking about engineering here. But I will touch on some of the other topics. So within the movement topics, there's three parts: biomechanics, board and interface mechanics, and the board performance. I'm going to break that down. Types of joints. Obviously, the way the body moves is really important when you think about how you're going to control a piece of equipment that you're trying to affect. And it's kind of helpful to think about how the different joints work. There's obviously a number of different kinds of joints within the body. Fused joints, typically think of the skull and the pelvis as fused joints. Simple hinge joints, so the knee and the elbow. Ball and socket joints. And complex joints. The ankle is kind of a complex joint in that it's part of it is a hinge. It's a simple hinge movement, except you can obviously move your foot side to side. Same with my wrist. So it's a combination of a couple of different joints. And thinking about how the body moves, you need to look at how those joints can perform. Then once you start to work with people with disabilities, you need to start to think about the limitations on those different parts of the body. So in general, I'm thinking about the body as having two major kinds of movement. There's a flexion and extension movement, bending the knees, standing up tall, same with all my joints, and a rotation. I'm just dividing them up into flexion, extension, and rotation. But what that will do is move my center of mass relative to the device that I'm using, the snowboard. And that's going to have a huge effect. All the pressure is going to be passed through my feet onto that board to control the snowboard. And the control results from large movements and small movements. We need a real combination of very large movements of the body, very large movements, and very fine movements within ankles, knees, and upper body for balance. And it's a combination of those that's really important, and understanding that that combination is important. The board mechanics. The shape of the board has been a huge part of how snowboarding has evolved. What's called side cut, the fact that it isn't a straight shape, it's an hourglass shape, is what enables a snowboard to turn. There's always been that little bit of tension between skiers and snowboarders. For a while, there were a lot of ski areas that didn't let snowboarders in. Well, if you look at skis these days, they're all shaped this way, and that's thanks to snowboarding. That concept came from snowboarding. Old skis, 10, 20 years ago, they were all that straight shape. You can turn them, but it's more difficult. Snowboarding developed the idea that this hourglass shape actually makes the turning more easy, and I'll go into how. So important things in a board are its length, its side cut, its stiffness. Bindings are important. How far apart your feet are on the board affects mechanically how the board works, as well as whether your toes point outwards or inwards, whether you're standing towards the toe edge of the board or towards the heel edge of the board, and the stiffness of the boots. And then in terms of how the board performs, this is how the professional body really focuses on how a snowboard performs. And I like to use the analogy of a plane because you've got degrees of movement that kind of mirror a plane. So we start off with rotation or pivot, the yaw movement. And it's a lot like steering a car. That's how people at the beginning of snowboarding learn how to steer a snowboard. Basically, rotation of my body. Very simple. But what it needs with the snowboard is for the snowboard to be relatively flat on the snow. If I stood on a flat snowboard, it'll turn like this. But if I tip it up on its edge, it's got some resistance to that. Obviously, when I'm on an actual slope, there's an issue that I don't want a flat board to slide down the board, so a lot of the time I'm keeping it up on an edge. Anybody here snowboard? Okay. Anybody ski? Okay, so you guys know that a flat device, whether it's a ski or a snowboard, will slide down a hill. So to counteract that, you're going to use some edge angle. And that's kind of like that roll along the axis, straight along the board, rolling it up on edge. That's going to resist a snowboard moving down a hill, but it's also going to be important for how we turn. It's a more advanced way of turning a snowboard. Fore-aft pressure gives us pitch. Now, a lot of people think for a snowboard that you can't tip it up and down like a plane can tip up and down because it's on a solid surface. Well, that's not entirely true. It's not a totally solid surface. If you ride in powder, that's very different. You can affect the pitch of the snowboard, whether the nose is up or down, and also for a lot of tricks. If you want to pull back onto a snowboard to do a trick, bounce off the tail, you're going to move your weight backwards. And then, I'm just going to touch on this briefly, I'm not going to go into it in a lot of detail. Something that's unique to snowboarding compared to skiing is that you can do something to a snowboard because you have two points of contact on it. You can twist the board along its axis. I can effectively pull up with my toes on one foot, push down with my toes on the other foot. and I twist the board along its axis. It gives it a way of steering a snowboard that you can't do in skiing. So, turning is a combination of, I said that to start with you might learn by this rotation, but actually to turn a ski or a snowboard, you turn it up on its edge and you flex it. And you flex it because your weight is in the middle. And that's putting weight onto the snowboard. And that hourglass shape then causes it to have a curved line in the snow. And you can kind of see in these pictures, the snowboard actually bends a little bit. So the snowboard's making a curved line in the snow, and it's a combination of that. Tilting it up on edge, putting weight in the middle, and a little bit of rotation in the upper body. So, I wanted to go over all of that first, because in order for somebody with some kind of disability to do this, you've got to consider what it is they can't do. And there may be a number of things that are going to be an obstacle for you. There could be a cognitive problem. You may have trouble getting across the information on how to ride on a snowboard. You may have a gross motor problem, a large movement problem, that could be, for instance, somebody with an above-knee amputation and a prosthetic down there. They're going to have very limited movement in big movements. Or it could be the fine control that's a problem. So a very typical initial setup for somebody with often a cognitive problem, also visual impairments, is to use these tethers. You tie them to there's a clamp here on the front of the snowboard. The instructor's behind them. And the great thing about that is that you can control somebody's speed. The problem with a snowboard, with skis, with a lot of gravity sports, is the more you point downhill, we use the term full line, which is downhill, the faster you're going to go. And for somebody who either can't see that, has no concept of it, has never been there before, that's terrifying, that they're going to speed up. The instructor can be behind them with these tethers and slow them down, give them a learning environment that controls that. They also can add that pivot, that rotation into it. By having two of them, you can rotate somebody. But the problem is you can't control any of this tilt or twist that I talked about, particularly the tilt. There's no control over that, and that's how a good turn happens. So we've got a limitation, and I worked with a lot of people with this setup, and we had problems with it. There was a limitation there. Also, because you're controlling the snowboard rather than the person, they're not really learning the movements that you want. If you start to move the board around, they're following the board. So this device was developed, and I've worked with this a fair amount. It's actually a windsurfing boom with a hip harness in the middle of it. And it attaches around the hips of the snowboarder. And then the instructor can hold onto that boom and be really anywhere around the student. I can be uphill of them, and hold them back, slow them down. I can be downhill so that I can see you more, talk to you, and still hold you back with it. And I can put that rotation into the hips so that the snowboarder will feel that rotation going on through their hips. So it allows both that rotation and the speed control. It's better than holding onto somebody directly. I can stand behind you and hold onto your shoulders, but you're likely to lean against me and to compensate for that. So this is a good piece of equipment for that. But again, we're not addressing any of this board tilt. So piece of equipment that I worked with, the guy who designed it, worked on some development of, is based on a skiing device called the slider. This is based on a regular, there's actually two of them here. There's a child's one and an adult one. It's based on a walker frame with skis on. And the idea is that for somebody who doesn't have the, where's that laser pointer? Lower body strength, you can see here that they're using this for some upper body support. And then the instructor has these tethers to him. So they've got a lot of control there, but it's moving away from the strength that's required in the lower body for skiing. That's great, but the problem is it's not helping him with how he's skiing. It's just taking weight off there. So we worked on something that would be similar for snowboarding, and it turned out to have a few extra advantages. This is called a rider bar. You can see the snowboard here. The bindings aren't there, but would actually mount right on top of these metal plates. So the screws go through the plates and hold it on. And there's actually a handle on the back here, but that's kind of an extra. You'll see it in the following slide. But the main thing is the snowboarder is going to stand here and hold onto this bar. You can see it a little better in this picture. So here's a snowboarder with this bar and a skier next to him. You can either have a skier or a snowboarder there. So the idea is that with the upper body, you've got some support, that you can hold onto this bar, but you've also got the ability to start that tilt of the snowboard from your upper body. This is an early development model of that. Doug talked a little bit about prototyping. Here's PVC tubing glued together. It would break pretty much every day out. Luckily, that ride is pretty light, pretty small. But that was part of the development process for this product. They adjusted the lean on it, adjusted the angles, and then they moved over to this one, which was made by a company called Freedom Factory. They do a lot of semi-custom sports equipment. I think Peter Axelson might mention them, particularly in the skiing and snowboarding area. So this has little devices. Actually, if I go back one, these things have screw threads in them, and you can adjust the lean of this bar, how much it leans forwards. And that gives you the ability to get that rider to push or pull on that board. What we found with this early version is there's a seat on it. You can see that she's actually sitting on that seat. And that's great. It gives her some support, but it does mean that she's really not controlling the board as much as she might. It's more the instructor's doing a lot more of the work. He's holding onto that handle at the back, and he's holding her up. He's making the turns for her. We took that seat away and tried having just a basic loop around the back. Again, that's something that people tend to rely on, sitting back on that loop. And it, for some level of disability, that works well. But for certain people who want to be able to ride this semi-independently or at least do a lot more of the turning work themselves, we took all that assistance out. And we worked with some people with cerebral palsy who would pull and push that bar and really tip the snowboard on edge and ride around on intermediate runs, still with an instructor. Still, I was typically holding snowboarding right next to the student, holding onto that bar, just giving them the backup to know that they weren't going to fall. But we were going on intermediate runs at the same speed as a regular skier or snowboarder. We'll get that at the end. So a number of different disabilities. Visually impaired people have used this setup, not necessarily because it helps them with the actual process of snowboarding, but it gives them a confidence factor. It gives them a way to hold onto that bar and tip that over. I wish I had some video of this riding because it's a really interesting development that it gives you that tilt. That's why I went through some of those mechanics of how snowboards work, because it gives you the ability to tip a snowboard over on edge that none of the other assistive equipment gives you. We've worked with, as I say, visually impaired people, cerebral palsy, and also a couple of single amputees. And it works very well. It's now starting to be standardized and used across the U.S. by skiing and snowboarding outfits. There's an organization up in Tahoe, Disabled Sports USA, and they have a couple of instructors that we've trained on using this equipment. So I just wanted to touch on whitewater rafting without going into too much of the equipment stuff. Although equipment's important, for a lot of people, I know we talked early on about somebody who was disabled and used a violin and whether they use some assistive technology for that. And it's easy to get caught up in the technology to fix the problem, but the problem is that we want people to go and do these things. Some people, I've worked with people with learning problems, kids with autism, ADD, and snowboarding in some cases is the only thing that they can focus on, the only situation where they can be very focused. In fact, Sean White, who's probably the best snowboarder in the world, is one of the best snowboarders because he's very, very ADD. And snowboarding and skateboarding are the only things that he really focuses on. So he spends all his time doing them. That's why he's so much better than everybody else. I understand Michael Phelps might have a learning problem as well. So whitewater rafting, we just want to get people out there. I work with an organization called Environmental Traveling Companions. I'm going to do a little bit of a pitch for them. They're based up in San Francisco. They use a lot of volunteers. And if anybody wants to be a whitewater rafting guide, we can teach you, and you can work with disabled people. We want to get people out rafting because it's fun. And for some people, it's an adrenaline rush. For some people, it's about facing fear. For some people, it's about seeing the great outdoors. For some people, it's about all of those. We have an accessible camp with an accessible kitchen, accessible bathrooms, accessible camping sites. And we typically work with organizations, but we also work with individuals. So we typically have two kinds of rafting setup. This is a standard rafting setup. Guides in the back with a longer paddle than everybody else, but basically the same. And we've done this with visually impaired participants. We've had half the boat as visually impaired participants, and the other half of the boat is people there to assist them. The other typical setup that we used, it's kind of hard to see, but this is with somebody who is normally in a wheelchair with a spinal cord injury, and he's sitting in a plastic lawn chair. That's all it is. It's a plastic lawn chair. Actually, the legs are cut off, and it's sat on a tube that runs across the boat. There's something behind it to support it. It's about using the simplest solution we could find, the minimum solution. Now, there are some considerations with whitewater rafting. The thing that you don't want is you don't want them fixed into the boat. If the boat turns over, you want them swimming away. A lot of people ask, can I not have a seatbelt? No. No. If the boat turns over, we want you swimming away. And because of that, we don't want anything around that could get tangled on you. So we're very aware of anything, any kind of rigging, anything on the boat that's going to get tangled on people to minimize that. So this setup was great. The problem with this setup is we had somebody come up and he wanted to go rafting with his family. He'd been out on this setup before, and typically we'll put trained people either side of you to assist. We could have family members, but he had his brother, his sister-in-law, and his nephew, and he wanted all of them to come rafting with him because he loved rafting and he wanted them to come along. Well, this setup, it won't work. So how do we get that many people into a boat with somebody with a disability? Again, it's not very complicated. We just took that seat and mounted it in the middle of the boat. Again, we're being very careful with entrapment hazards. We're trying to get all the straps, everything, out of the way so there's no danger of getting caught under there. And we can't have anything that would hold the guy in here. But then we've moved the oar frame that you saw here to the back of the boat. And that's a fairly common setup. It's not used a lot. So simple solution, not very mechanical, allows us to take the whole family rafting. Again, the experience is an important part of this. Taking simple solutions, not going overboard, excuse the pun, with the technology, but really looking, what is it that we're trying to solve? We're trying to solve this guy going rafting with his family. He had a fantastic time. He's been back with us a number of times, and we've started to work on moving this chair up to the side of the boat so that he gets a chance to paddle. It's hard for him to paddle. He doesn't really have the muscle coordination to do that, but he's working on it. So, in the spirit of this accessible recreation being as much about the opportunity for people to do that, I brought a little video. Can we run that? Environmental Traveling Companions, actually on the last slide. We need to take the volume down for this as well. Right? Did you already?
Yeah.
On the last slide, it does have the website for ETC. This is a guy I've worked with. This is not me riding with him. He's totally blind. If you listen carefully, you can hear the instructor talking to him. The level of instruction he's giving him is very low. He's been snowboarding 5 years, I think, and he comes out maybe 3 weeks a winter. He's competed in national championships now in board across and half pipe. I've taken him in the half pipe a couple of times. That's quite exciting. One of the great things about working with somebody who's visually impaired is that actually sighted people, when you're teaching them to snowboard and you tell them what to do with their body, they look, and that stops them standing up straight. These guys know where their body is, and they feel it, and they get it. And David actually gets it very well, gets it very quickly. He can really feel that board moving underneath him.
And they have a good sense of balance, apparently.
Very good sense of balance. So, any questions? If anybody's interested in ETC, come and talk to me afterwards. They do have a great program. It's a great way to get involved. They also work with, they have a sea kayak program on the bay, and they have a cross-country ski program.
Okay. Thanks so much, Owen.
Thanks, Dave.
Another props to show us?
Oh. Yeah. I actually just brought a snowboard along because I didn't realize I had the little one. Binding angle can be a big part. The angle that you stand can really affect the body movement. And it's something that an understanding of working with people with disabilities really makes you better understand how it works for able-bodied people. Those body mechanics I was talking about, if I'm going to rely on my knee movement a lot, how far out that front foot is turned, how far out that back foot is turned, really affects how my knees flex as I go up and down. And you'll see a lot of people really limited in their movement on a snowboard because of the way their bindings are set up. That's about it. They rotate. There are screws right under here, and they have a full 360-degree rotation. But they're fixed in place. This is what works best for me. But for somebody else, it would be totally different. I am fortunate that it's not totally uncommon. When you're born, your toes point inwards. Most people are pigeon-toed. And then as you grow, your hips develop and your feet move out. Mine didn't move out as much as is most common. And so my angles tend to be a little closer together than most people. And I worked in a rental store where somebody came in and said, my instructor's telling me that my angles are set up all wrong, but they feel really comfortable to me. And he says I've got to move them out because everybody else has them like this, and I've got to have them like this. And we talked, and it turned out he had the same situation. And so just by being able to understand that people's development is going to be different really helps you. Any questions? Thanks.
I just want to reiterate what we saw today was engineers giving people access to the bicycle. So when you're a kid, you're expected to ride a bicycle. If you're a disabled kid, you want to be a bicycle. So, same thing with a snowboard. You don't want to do the things that other people do to be a part of your community and your friendship group and things like that. So this is really important stuff. And you can see the role that mechanical engineering has played in, making this assistive technology happen. Okay. If there's no further questions, then everybody can leave. Thank you.